So we will now go over to the panel discussion. And so Nina, Anna, and Stefan, and Christoph. Thank you all very much. And I think what we have heard that we are dealing with an area full of challenges and with difficult decisions and actions to take in the short run and in the long run, but also issues that we really need to deal with. And I would like to start with a general question and actually what you, Ulrika, talked about also, that our objective, the objective of Sweden's Development Corporation it concerns, we have to create the conditions that can improve the situation for people that are poor and under oppression. That's the overall objective. And we also have the Millennium, Sustainable Development Goals telling us that we should leave nobody behind. What does that tell us on migration and development? I will start with that general question and maybe put, you already developed that, Ulrika, but put it to, but start with you, Stefan, who are new now on the panel.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a big question and kind of a difficult one, but when you look at the overall goal for Sweden's policy, obviously there is huge room for migration and especially in regards to different parts of the migration situation. But it's also clear, both in the budgetary rules and the purpose of the migration cost, that the in-donor costs that are mentioned here within the budget is not supposed to fulfill that goal. It has a different goal in its different utgiftsområde. And this is a part that has been deducted from aid. So that part has not so far been included in support to reach that goal. So that should we have in mind when we're discussing the volume of aid towards that goal, that this part is not supposed to be included, or at least not measured or monitored towards that goal. So when we talk about migration efforts from Swedish aid budget, it is supposed to be other areas that is concerned.
Yeah, we will come back to the in-donor refugee costs. And now, Nina, you want to comment that general question?
Yeah, well, maybe I can respond first as a person or as a citizen of the global north, because somehow I think the root causes may as well be located in the global north as in the global south, but we never talk about it. Global inequality is definitely behind this, and I think we need to expect in the future that our level of wealth and level of consumption needs to be affected if we are to create a more just world. I also think we need to understand that limiting the access for other people to our systems of governance and our access to wealth will in the end create more problems than solutions. Secondly, development aid is actually a very limited factor in the global economy. So let's also be straight about that. It's definitely lower than remittances. So we need to see that in perspective. In terms of being a migration researcher and being oriented, my research is very much about looking into the migrant perspective, talking to migrants in different parts of the world. My research tells me that it is not necessarily poverty that uproots people. It is corruption. It is not lack of jobs necessarily, but lack of decent and stable employment based on qualifications, where you do not need to be networked to people in power, and where you know that you can keep that job. And then it's generalized violence. Mm. So if we are to sort of approach these issues, they are clearly laid out, and we could create policies on these issues.
Yeah. Christoph, these are issues that are very, should be close to the African countries in the African Union. How do they discuss their own problems to deal with this?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of activity ongoing within the African Union, for example, and the various regions of Africa, the 5-6 regions. There is, to some extent, cooperation, and also the Valletta Agreement between the EU and Africa included an additional focus on regional economic cooperation. We have the ECOWAS region, for example, in West, Northwest Africa, which has, similar to the EU, free mobility, passport, visa-free mobility, shared labor markets, and this can be a source of inspiration to other regions in Africa to work closely. And if you regard that in contrast to the EU-Africa migration and mobility issue, it could also open up alternatives to migration to cross the Mediterranean to have opportunities within Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think if we look at the general purpose of development cooperation, poverty reduction, and strengthening the self ability of people to develop their own lives, there are three D's that we need to think about: development, demography, and democracy. And they are all interlinked with the reasons of migration that we see today and in the future. In regards of development or lack of development, we have mismanaged economies, jobless growth, chronic unemployment, inequality, poverty. In terms of demography, we see a very substantial increase of the population in Africa, the only continent where you have an increase which is notable, where other regions like Europe is aging. So there we have an issue of youth unemployment. What to do with all the young people in Africa who cannot find jobs, and where you might have unemployment rates between 20 and 50% in some countries. And democracy or lack of democracy, we have governance issues, political oppression, human rights abuse, unstable politics or ethno-religious conflicts. And all these, of course, need to be attended to in development cooperation, and to various extents they influence migration patterns.
Yes, thank you. Ulrika, these are all issues of what you find in failed state or failed that are fragile. And I know that is something that you have been working on. How do you see that relating to the migration issue? Or what can we do in these states where conditions are not good for people, where they feel that they better leave?
Well, the reason why we have focused on conflict and failed and fragile states is not because people are leaving those countries. I think it's important to stay with the assignment that we have been given on taking decision upon in Parliament, and that is the goal for our development cooperation. The reason is because we see that there is a very worrying trend, and this was also expressed very clearly in the Addis Ababa action plan, that less funds from development cooperation are actually going to the countries that need it the most. And therefore Sweden has focused also on how to direct more funds to fragile and conflict-ridden states.
And do we manage to work well there also?
Well, we need to find ways to do so, and this is also a task by the Agenda 2030, not to leave countries behind. The majority and an increasing number of the poorest people live and will live in conflict-ridden states.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is something that we have decided upon and that Sweden has decided to deliver on as well.
Yeah. Anna, is that well understood also in the EU discussions that you need to have a long-term perspective on working with troubled countries?
Well, I think it is understood, but it's coming increasingly under pressure. And I want to pick up on the aspect of conflict sensitivity that was mentioned. I think that is really important in the engagement also we see with migration right now. If you take some examples from the EU Trust Fund, where I think there is a genuine attempt to sort of address some of the issues, human rights issues for migrants as well, but there is increasingly focus on managing irregular flows, for example, through the Sahel in Agadez, for example, incentivizing also countries to help to do that. Now, you could say, I think you could even argue that this is, you know, part of Agenda 2030 for orderly migration, because irregular migration is sort of not defined as orderly. But in sort of, I think you need to look at the African context and how mobility takes place and what it means for development, what it means sort of for the local economies that also profit, and then what it means to sort of come in and rapidly try to stop certain flows, what that sort of could mean from also a conflict angle and in perspective, knowing that potentially some of those people that do thrive on these economies, which may be good or bad, but in a short term may lose out. And the question is, okay, if you stop migrants, you trap them, potentially you have people who then, you know, sort of political economy factors changing and power struggles happening. What does that mean to conflict dynamics? I think that is really key to sort of, not sort of put the stopping of migrants or the reduction of flows first, but really think about these issues. And another point which I also find interesting, and I really second Nina on that, is that, I mean, this report we did was about ODA, so we really focus on development cooperation. But it's true that the whole debate on root causes in Europe is very much confined to development cooperation. And that is an odd thing, because we have the Agenda 2030, and we know all the policy coherence issues, and we know how different global policies interact. So I think we need to start also taking it out from the pure sort of development cooperation financing to the much broader policy level on how we may even fuel sort of root causes, if we call them mm-hmm. here.
It's less on the general foreign policy agenda or security agenda causes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stefan, should we can talk now about the in-donor refugee costs and what are the chances that we'll get an agreement of improvement in the DAC, but you have the floor first.
Thank you. The thing is, this is one of the probably most clear and automatic link between migration and the developing policy, at least the cost wise, and it's also mentioned very good in the report. However, there are some areas that's lacking, not due to I guess to your work, but to the availability of the numbers. And as you write, there is no way to go below these aggregated numbers that reports are mentioning. But I would like to question one of the main statements in this, and it doesn't come from you, it comes from the DAC numbers, and it's that we actually have had an increasing level of aid despite this one. As far as I can see, and this it's mainly due to the big discrepancy, as you write about, between the DAC reporting numbers and the Swedish numbers in the budget, and it's a huge gap between them, because we report in a way that we can't work with in the budget. So this gap is huge. For example, in ODA's last year or 2015, the total aid volume was 60 billion, and in the Swedish government's bokslut, I don't know the word, it was 40 billion, and the deductions are huge. So this is a different. And when I look at the numbers in the budget, in the Swedish official bokslut, then I can't see that aid has actually grown at all since 2009. So that's one big theme here, I think. And that means, I think, if we take this concept of additionality, that this has been, we can take both refugees and pay for them with ODA money, but it hasn't affected the growth of ODA. I think we need to have the facts clear.
Mm-hmm. Can we reach a new DAC agreement? Are we working on it?
It was said there is a working group to clarify how we should report, and I agree. I think we should, and there is no reason not to have more transparency and clarity in this in order to have a good discussion, but also to compare between countries and donors, but also in between years. However, with the discussion that we've had within the OECD DAC, I'm a bit worried about opening up. I mean, we need to modernize, but opening up so far has not meant perhaps improved quality for our development cooperation. Sweden has been concerned about the opening up for costs for for security, which we think is really on the border of what is really effective development cooperation. So I think, and this is the way we also see that the working group works now, that we really need to focus on clarification and to see too that there is more transparency, that, so that we have possibilities to have a good discussion.
Can I just, with all due respect, that's this discussion has been going on for like 30 years with the same ambitions, and every time it has fallen on that some countries hasn't been able or willing to change their policy because they cannot afford it in that budget year. So this, I completely recognize the problems here. I'm not so optimistic that it will be solved because this is not the first time we've had the exact same discussion about the exact same cost. But the difference is now, and that's important in this regard. The difference now is that earlier, small amendments in the rules didn't mean much, and we could add in cost items, and it didn't show, and it didn't mean much. But with this irregularity, that's what happened the last couple of years, that small differences within the rules means difference or miscalculations, or the small details means difference with billions of Swedish aid money, just how you look at the rules. And when then that's not... we really need to be focused on the details in this discussion, both in the EU level, in the DAC level, certainly also in the national perspective. And I think we haven't been able to do that because we don't have any numbers.
But may I ask you, what about, is it okay to use aid money for the maintenance of refugees in the neighbourhood of Syria and so on? So humanitarian support for refugees in other countries.
Yes.
How does that compare with humanitarian support to refugees managing to get here?
I think that has to be clarified. And the DAC secretariat's perspective on this has been that's why they have wanted to take this away from the guidelines, because this is Swedish costs. And when we support aid, it's not supposed to... The goal that is also written in this report is not to support Swedish authority in this cost. When their rationality is here, they say, when we give money to Pakistan to take care of refugees, Afghan refugees in Pakistan, then it's aid to Pakistan, or to help them cope with that. And this is Swedish. That has been there. And I'm not saying either argument is right here. I just want us to have the actual numbers and discuss it in a way that is fact-based and clear.
You could also say it's helped to individuals who we don't know whether they will stay or not.
Yeah, but so, that's not the
But what's about the Danish discussion?
Yeah, well, I think in addition to what you discuss, I mean, we need to be clear of the longer-term geopolitical consequences of providing aid to countries for taking care of refugee situations, especially because most of these countries have already enormous burdens. I mean, after it's been visible since the Valletta summit, but the EU-Turkey deal has shown most refugee-hosting countries that there are huge deals out there that you can negotiate. And we are creating, perhaps unintendedly, a situation where states that we do not necessarily agree with, states that we used to have a critical human rights dialogue with, now become, or we are giving them a bargaining tool. And it can already be seen in the Turkish case that the criticism towards several practices in Turkey has not been really been there. So I think it goes beyond a question of money, a question of how we count them. I think really we need to see ourselves in a world that is becoming fragile also, and that we are part of it. And these deals that we strike are changing our geopolitical power. I mean, I think so.
In fact, this is one of the elements in the report that sort of indicators that we are doing too much in countries where that are of concern for us, so affecting the flow of refugees. Have we done too much for the Syrian refugees in the neighborhood there? For instance, Ulrika.
But yeah, may I comment? I think, I mean, this is crucial, of course, and I just want to state that we had the visit of Merkel here this week, that if European Union would have taken responsibility as a union with the responsibilities of all member states, I mean, we could have dealt with the situation in 2015. And this was also the position of Sweden, and this is still the position that we see to, that we need to have a scheme where we find all countries in European Union taking responsibility, and then, of course, Europe will manage. And this is the future, as you said. We have to have politics that relate to the situation of the world. And, I mean, there are many reasons for that also in our own interest with the few children being born in Southern Europe and so on. So, I mean, at some point, Europe needs to find a way to both take responsibility, but also look at the opportunities that migration bring. But as you know, and this is also, I think, the situation in OECD DAC, I wish you would have represented one of the countries, Staffan, but the discussion, the political discussion, and I think it's obvious to you, is not perhaps the most, the best environment for changes that many of us would think would be changes in a good direction. But hopes for clarification, yes, I do have these hopes.
Yes, you want to comment?
Actually, one aspect of this also is that it's not only that migration, this link between migration and aid that we have created with these budgetary rules, it also goes back into the other direction. As I think, I mean, most of us here, I hope everyone here, accept the fact that, yes, we should have, as you said, Europe has to take its responsibility, Sweden, and we want to have a system with a clear asylum rights that we can generously and according to these rules help people that is, I mean, no one questioning either aid or the refugee cost. But creating this automatic economic link between them gives an argument to both those groups that want to stop refugee migration and to those who want to cut foreign aid. Because as we see in Sweden right now, we have those two arguments. Look here, we take in money and poor people in Africa is hurting. And how awful that argument still is, the link is there, and we have created this trade-off. It's not automatically every single time, but we have created a trade-off between refugee migration and foreign aid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we should... Just a small comment. Yeah. I mean, I agree, and I think that, I mean, what happened in 2015 showed also the huge problem of having this link, because the model then showed that we would have a deduction of 60% of our development cooperation funds. Mm. So, of course, there is a problem. We have to recognize this. And this was also why we took a decision in government to limit the deduction to 30% to see to that we at least stay with the 0.7 goal, and we can be clear on this. Even though we count our refugee costs according to the OECD DAC system. But there are also trade-offs in all areas of politics. Mm-hmm. And this was also shown in 2015 and 2016 and also presented in the budget. And the predictability of planning, of course, changes when you have changes in society.
It was not only
the short argument according to that. That's actually my main argument, that trade-off and that decision has to be taken. And you did it very good. You took up, you didn't follow, or you made this ceiling at 30%. But in all other areas, we take them up in a democratic way and discuss them, and it's up to the government to decide. Is it fair to that this also should affect that and this trade-off? It's reasonable. I support that trade-off or that discussion making, but I would like the government to have the opportunity to make it according to its principles and not by budgetary rules. That's my argument here.
Yeah, but It has hardly been noticed here in Sweden that actually aid in 2015 is reported to 1.45.
This is because we use the system of how we have reported before, but we haven't talked about it because we have our 1% Gini goal, we have our budget, and we report in Sweden towards our budget. But to the OECD DAC, we report the full number of asylum seekers according to the system of deduction of funds. So we have asked not to use that figure because we don't think it's in line with the decision taken in government and reported to Parliament, and we have used our own figure. But this is because the DAC system has been used like this over many years.
Of course, at this time, we have seen also that humanitarian assistance is increasing, and for good reasons. It has to be increased because it's a troubled world, and we don't know what will happen now with the new elephant in the room, the big Trump. there you have this discussion on how to put a long-term perspective into humanitarian assistance also, building human capital and so on. Is that how far has that gone? Is that a good idea? Does it work? Or you even warned about it, that we have too much incentives for bad states when we use a lot of money to improve the situation for refugees in these places. That's a dilemma.
I'm not sure I would put it in that way. I think I put it more in terms of geopolitical power balance and our room for negotiation would be my argument, and not necessarily the other way around.
No, but you mentioned this as a promising area in the report.
Yes, because it has been discussed for so long in the sort of migration and development arena to actually, I mean, we know there's displacement situations that are protracted for a very long time, and donors, but also sort of the hosting communities, treating them as humanitarian sort of emergency type situation that are ongoing for several years. And that sort of shift in mindset, I think, has been fueled also by the situation now, because we have seen in our neighborhood, and maybe with increased sort of flows coming, that this may be a good idea, because a lot of the people are hosted actually in developing countries in the region, but also globally. I mean, it's not Europe that hosts the most people, and it does create a lot of development pressure for host nations, and sort of issues of rights come up for those migrants or refugees in these situations. So I think yes, it's a good idea. I think it's a bit different from the point that Nina made. You mentioned that the report says whether we do too much in these areas. I don't think so. We have still a lot of underfunding, and I think globally we need to think about it in combination of what type of sort of global responsibility sharing we have, both sort of financially in supporting places that host large amounts of refugees, as well as in terms of what, you know, Europe is doing in taking in or resettle migrants. And now with Trump, yes, shaking up things even more, I think that'll be difficult, but it's to be sort of seen in that context in terms of, the responsibility sharing model. And I mean, there's obstacles maybe ahead with, you know, bringing humanitarian actors and development actors closer together. I mean, I think that people are generally moving forward and working on it. But in one interesting aspect that came out, and it's only a small part of the report, but there were some fears of people we interviewed that actually, while bringing development actors closer to these displacement situations, what we may risk with seeing, and maybe you can look at the EU Trust Fund, was mentioned in interviews, is that it goes a bit step too far, that a lot of sort of the longer term aid or foreseen aid to deal with these situations is, you know, used for very short term service delivery type expenditures where we may be even seeing sort of an increasingly development cooperation for long term being used in a more short term and service delivery manner rather than really working with structures.
Christoph wanted to say something.
Maybe we can also look at the broader picture, starting from the Sustainable Development Goals and what's happening there, migration in the 2030 agenda. And that has brought in now recently the IOM, International Organization for Migration, into the UN family, and it used to operate separately before. But this can help because IOM has a lot of field offices around the world. It's represented in many places, and it has the migration expertise that has been lacking in the development community. In the past, migration experts and development experts operated on their separate planes. And now it's time to bring them together to look at how to cooperate and how to understand each other's fields of expertise. And for IOM, it's important to integrate itself together with UNHCR, ILO, UNDP, the World Bank, and other UN agencies that have worked on migration issues. But the UNHCR is underfunded, so we still have the challenges in terms of the refugee population, how to distribute refugees more evenly across the globe. Resettlement is not used. So now Filippo Grandi, the new UNHCR chief, is looking at alternative options, legal routes, labor migration, scholarships, working with the neighborhood. So there is a need to reconsider the whole issue of how to incorporate work on refugee matters and migration matters with the global community.
Ulrika. Humanitarian support is four times higher than it was 10 years ago.
Pardon?
It's four times higher than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And we only have 50% of coverage of the appeals for humanitarian support. But we do have, and I think we need to look closer to this, new partnerships that are of interest, bridging also humanitarian support, long-term support, and also bringing in migration aspects with capacity such as IOM, but also interesting collaboration between UNHCR, for instance, and the World Bank, where they look at the possibility to really work in a way where you strengthen not only the migrants or the refugees in this case, but also the host communities and their possibility to give ground for a good development, not only for the people who come, but also for the whole community to be more conflict sensitive.
Yeah. That, and I think these are promising development, and there is also more discussion about increasing the UNHCR quotas and so on. Although United States is now decreasing theirs. I wear a Palestinian jacket today, and I was there with UNRWA for a long time, for some time, and one of the aspects there, which I think is very relevant in what we are talking about now, that is actually how to build human capital also among refugees, and it's very much related to education, possibilities, scholarships, whatever, and so this I think is a promising development, but of course volumes are probably all too small. Because many of the situations we have learned, they are very protracted. They go on for a long time. And what's happening with people meanwhile? And what will they do after? If they one day can move back home, or if they become part of a diaspora, they need the capacity to deal with their own lives. And maybe this is a promising development that you are talking about now with international organization coming together around people. Will they have resources?
Yes, I think all actors working on or branding their work in relation to migration will have resources for reasons. But what's important is to see that the resources are also combined with good policies and practices, as I said before. I also wanted to mention in relation to the commitment made by the European Union and the African states in Valletta that we were quite concerned. Swedish development funds would have gone into through the EDF anyway, so we decided also to follow it and monitor it closely. And what we have seen through close monitoring, and I mean we have the possibility also to share this with some of you who might be interested, we can see that the majority of projects that we have seen are actually kind of traditional development cooperation projects, while there are some projects that I think needs to be discussed and that where Sweden also have had discussions within the board.
But this also raises the question, so why do we then need to repackage, and why don't we see how we develop the Commission's work on a more long-term basis to address, together with other agencies such as IOM and UNHCR and all the development community, how to deal on a more long-term basis with both the positive but then also the negative aspects of